When I had the vision of putting Swarovski back to the forefront of fashion and following my grandfather's footstep, Manfred, who worked directly with Christian Dior and Coco Chanel, that is exactly what I wanted to do, you know, and I was looking for my Christian Dior and I eventually found him with McQueen. At that time in the company, nobody was associating Swarovski in fashion, and I was alone. But I found a person who supported my vision, and that was Isabella Blow. And she truly was a fashion historian, and she knew about Swarovski Crystal within fashion. And she's like, oh my gosh, it's such a no-brainer. Let's go. Let's meet Lee. I have to say there was resistance, and there was a lack of belief. But I was allowed to do my experiment. And you know what? My experiment worked. And my experiment brought a financial return. And I've had those kind of exercises over and over and over again. I don't want to say I'm a rebel. I don't believe in rebelling against people, but I totally believe in sticking to a good idea.
A rebel very much with a cause, Nadia Swarovski has reinvented the brand started by her great-great-grandfather via a series of collaborations with the avant-garde of fashion, design and architecture. As head of corporate communications and design services at Swarovski, Nadia's brought in talents such as Alexander McQueen and Zaha Hadid to work with the company's world-famous crystal, combining centuries of craftsmanship and engineering with cutting-edge creativity. And Nadia's brought a Swarovski sparkle to the silver screen too, working with directors and costume designers on films like Black Swan and Skyfall. Nadia also sits on the board of the company and keeps a close eye on everything from manufacturing to corporate culture to sustainability, ensuring that its recent endeavours align with its traditional values. I'm delighted to welcome Nadia Swarovski for this season's finale of The Big Interview. Nadia, thank you so much for coming to see us at Midori House. Welcome to The Big Interview.
It's so great to be here.
Well, the pleasure is all ours. Let me just start off by asking you about, I apologise if you've been asked this a million times, which maybe you have, stewarding the family name. I mean, it's illustrious, it symbolises so much, it's iconic, etc. How have you gone about that business? There's this idea of being innovative and yet at the same time respecting the heritage, the tradition. Is that a course you've found easy to walk all through your life, really?
It's my DNA. It's my heritage. I grew up with it. So I basically come from the family branch of Swarovski that I was born into the engineering branch. So my father has managed the manufacturing plant for 45 years, as has his father and so on. And of course, my father wanted me to study engineering, which perhaps today I regret not having done. I went off and studied art history thinking that that is so different. However, I realized, no, actually it's not. And this is exactly what brought me to Swarovski in the position that I am now. You know, I'm taking that heritage of engineering, but I'm adding that art and art historic element that takes and allows Swarovski to use its craftsmanship and its expertise, but put it in a beautiful design. Mm. And of course, my first job was with Gagosian Gallery, and it was interesting for me to actually watch how the customer was never really put in touch with the designer. And the designer to me is the heart and soul. And I truly believe in the transcendentalism of energy, of creation. Whatever a designer invests emotionally into an object permeates out to the end consumer. And I was missing that fully in the art world. So eventually, years later, I found myself within Swarovski. And that is exactly what I wanted to do.
I've heard you talk before about this idea of sort of art and engineering. And it may surprise some who maybe aren't so familiar with Swarovski, the whole company and all of these different entities, that mm-hmm. there is this extraordinary R&D facility. You know, in Austria, mm-hmm. there's that huge investment. Do you still feel, though, that you said that that's a change that's maybe happening across all of this sector and across society, but are we still not really good enough at understanding that really interesting marriage of art and engineering, the technical and the aesthetic? Do you sometimes still feel you're one voice when there should be more? Would you like to see more from others who work in this space, perhaps?
Well, I think, you know, what's also very important and for the consumer to understand is the creation process that is involved in creating a product. And I always felt the more the consumer understands how hard it is to create something, the greater the appreciation. That is why I think the entire engineering element, which always seems like this big black box actually needs to be exposed a bit more because it's not such a big black box. And it is actually logic. You know, engineering is nothing but creative problem solving. You know, it's interesting also we are seeing so many more female engineers. Certainly in North America, engineering and math is a subject matter that is that young girls are approaching more and more. I think we're seeing a definite change there. But in terms of Swarovski, it's true, you know, people just knew us from what we really stood for on the catwalk or on the silver screen. But one didn't quite understand the complex manufacturing that was really behind the creation of that sparkling ingredient. I have to say, when I initially started working at Swarovski, I was certainly approached by certain people in the diamond industry, and one lady said to me, she was the wife of a sideholder, "You're taking away our shelf space." I'm like, "What do you mean shelf space? This is the shelf space." And she was pointing at a décolletage. I'm like, "Oh, and now it's covered in crystal and not with diamonds." I'm like, "That's right." However, she was very dismissive about crystal. And my answer was, "Well, do you know how hard it is to make a crystal? Do you know the various different chemicals that have to come together, have to be sourced globally, and then melted together to come out of the melting pot like honey, then have to go into a hard metal mold? We have to wait for that to cool off. Only once it's cooled off, and it depends on the size of the crystal. If it's small, it cools off faster. If it's big, it takes up to 3 months to cool off. And only at that point, you can start cutting. And the cutting process has to be so perfect. So there is a tremendous amount of labor that is involved in creating this crystal. And it really made me think, you know what? We don't want to create a diamond imitation piece. We want to create a material that is totally creative in its own merit. And we want to use that creative material and put it into the hands of the most creatives out there, whether it's a fashion designer, jewelry designer, architecture, and so on, and see how they can truly demonstrate to use this crystal in a really creative way to ultimately enhance the creative expressive power of their design work. And I think that's been our path in the last 15 years. It's been effective. And then what we do on top of it, we celebrate that creator. And that is what has created such a beautiful symbiotic situation and also credibility in the design.
Well, let me ask you about that, because you've already talked about recognizing design, celebrating that creativity, and really getting that across to people. If we look back over your career, you've obviously collaborated with someone like Alexander McQueen, of course, this recognizing extraordinary talents at different stages of their own career development. Tell us a bit about the collaborative process and how that works for you. Is it about attitude? Is it about, I don't know, a shared vision, literally or metaphorically? How do you know when it's going to work?
Totally. And you know what? Our collaboration only works and will only be successful if the creator appreciates crystal as a material. And the way we figure out if there is an appreciation is by literally taking them either to a showroom or meeting them and putting crystal in front of them. And then how they react to the material, to me, says it all. Like, often I just show them material and I continue talking and I can tell they're not even listening to me anymore because they're captured by the material.
And is it literally a glint in the eye?
It literally is. That's, you know, that sparkle in the eye. There's a spark that flies and they're off. They're off. And I remember meeting with Lee McQueen and he didn't say much. We showed them the material and he was off. His head was down to the ground and he was off in a different world. It was so amazing then to see what he did with that product on the catwalk. And I do have to say, the minute McQueen started to use Swarovski crystal, all the other fashion designers wanted to use Swarovski crystal. So he, to me, had a huge impact on our sales, on our brand. That is really why Swarovski felt very strongly to support the Alexander McQueen exhibition at the V&A. It was our tribute to him. It is a name and a person that we want to celebrate. We feel the passion immediately towards the material. And then what we also look at is the designer's background and repertoire, how they have used different materials. So in the case of McQueen, again, just to use him as an example, because it is now such a well-known name, he certainly was a great appreciator of materials. You know, he worked with wood, with leather, with plastics, and he really was able to position the material in order to get the most out of it. So for us, it requires having such thoughtful people who know exactly how to use the material in the best way. And, you know, we appreciate also the relationships of the designers that push us beyond our comfort zones. We had a little dinner for John Pawson, who is creating the trophy for the Fashion Awards. John, certainly product developers love to work with because the final result is always beautiful, but they're also a little bit scared always when they work with him because he always pushes us beyond our comfort zone. And he always says, yeah, that's nice, but can't you do this? And
on that point, how difficult is it to, I guess, work with people that you know are going to be challenging in that way? And again, for yourself, if you're stewarding a successful business, the temptation must always be there to say, well, look, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. We can just keep on keeping on. How acute is that desire, that need to keep pushing like that?
You know, every single time we work with a designer, for us, it's an exercise in research and development. Mm. And it's for free. And it's a dialogue. And that is amazing. You know, we know that crystal making down pat perfectly. We are so reliant on the creative and artistic vision of these designers. And yes, we need to be pushed out of our comfort zone. You know, and the more we are, the greater the result. Again, back to engineering. The engineers always find a solution. Engineering is creative problem solving. And so, no, we absolutely appreciate that process. I mean, one other great example was working with Zaha, the latest piece that she did for Swarovski, for the Atelier Swarovski Home collection. It is a crystal that has a curve. And for Swarovski, it's so hard to create a curve shape in the crystal, the concave shape. We were able to do her piece. There's only one man in the factory who's able to do that piece and knows how to manage or handle the certain machine which can do it. And we appreciate that, you know, it's
great.
Well,
I guess you don't, and you go into a collaboration like that knowing that, again, the envelope is going to be pushed.
We are ready, absolutely.
There's always a bit of, or there can often be, a degree of small-c conservatism, for example, on the boards of companies, because a lot of what you've described is trusting to that creative, and it can be very dynamic, very sort of explosive energy, creative energy. It's quite hard to quantify. You know, you can't set that in a ledger, profit and loss, that unknown thing that just makes the difference. Mm-hmm. You know, you sit on the board as well. Is it a challenge sometimes to convey to people who may be slightly more interested in the bottom line?
Yes.
How do you go about trying to kind of quantify that?
It's a huge challenge. And sometimes the word design seems to be a dirty word in an environment that is not design-driven. And sometimes I have to say, I go home and I feel like I'm actually speaking Chinese. And but no, it's the power of conviction and then the power of convincing other people that gets you there. I always say that creativity actually is the biggest contribution to commerce, to the bottom line. And, you know, at the end of the day, is the consumer going to choose something really boring or something totally exciting? And of course, it's something totally exciting that the consumer will choose. Are you going to take that boring toothbrush or that cutting-edge toothbrush? You know, it's a process. What I then also like to do sometimes is introduce the designer to the board because it makes it more personal and more credible. Another example of a product that was really hard to make was the Cinderella slipper, which we created for Sandy Bowell, the costume designer for the Cinderella movie, which was directed by Kenneth Branagh. She called up and said, look, I'm the costume designer. Can you do the crystal slipper? And we said, of course. So she came to Austria, and it was so hard to do, again, because of that concave shape within the shoe.
Your man there who operates the concave machine, he had his work cut out,
didn't he? It was him again, Walter. And Walter got to work. And I have to say, they had to do quite a few prototypes. And I have to say, for the Swarovski staff or employees, it's very hard to watch the movie because the stepmother breaks the shoe after so many hours of making it. It's really painful to watch that. No, but so in any case, we were debating, should we sell this shoe or not? And the marketing department thought, no, it's going to be too expensive. It's going to cost 2,000 euros. Who has the money to pay for that? And I said, can we please just do a limited edition? So we did 888 Cinderella slippers for 2,000 euros, and it sold out in 3 days. So it just shows you, it's such a good example. If it's a product that has a lot of creativity, emotion invested in it, and if it's a product that actually also stands for something, the consumer will pay for it. Which woman does not want to have Cinderella slipper?
Well, this is what I was going to ask you. You mentioned a couple of times already this idea about being brave, following the courage of your convictions. And I know you've spoken again before about having to follow, you know, your passion. There are people who are very outwardly successful in whatever they might be doing, but are they really passionate about what they're doing? I know you also spend a lot of time talking to up and coming designers, the next generation of design leaders, business leaders indeed, if they ever say to you, look, I'm worried, I think it's sometimes hard to be brave like that, how do you reassure them that it is always worth it in the end?
Well, the thing is, you have to have purpose in what you're doing. You know, we don't create things in order to create things. No, we actually create things, in our case, to make people's lives better, to enhance people's lives with the products that we're able to give to them. So I think if your purpose is the right purpose, then you're probably on the right track and you should just allow yourself to continue having faith in yourself and in the outcome. And it is so hard sometimes, especially if, you know, the world seems to be against you. What has helped me is truly to get the facts behind it, whether it's a logical justification, whether it's business facts, whether it is really statistics, that really helps. And then also, you have to find people that believe in your mission. When I had the vision of putting Swarovski back to the forefront of fashion and following my grandfather's footstep, Manfred, who worked directly with Christian Dior and Coco Chanel, that is exactly what I wanted to do, you know, and I was looking for my Christian Dior and I eventually found him with McQueen. At that time in the company, nobody was associating Swarovski in fashion, and I was alone. But I found a person who supported my vision, and that was Isabella Blow. And she truly was a fashion historian, and she knew about Swarovski crystal within fashion. And she's like, oh my gosh, that's such a no-brainer. Let's go. Let's meet Lee. I have to say there was resistance, and there was a lack of belief. But I was allowed to do my experiment. And you know what? My experiment worked. And my experiment brought a financial return. And I've had those kind of exercises over and over and over again. I don't want to say I'm a rebel. I don't believe in rebelling against people, but I totally believe in sticking to a good idea.
So a rebel with a cause then?
Rebel with a complete cause and purpose.
And what about how that more progressive approach filters down into the company? I know that there's a lot of regard to the sort of employee engagement program inside Swarovski.
Exactly.
And you're very connected to, again, demonstrating by doing, even with you know, within the company. And these are not necessarily things that everyone will see, but there's an understanding that that progressive attitude needs to be something that everyone can share. Did that meet resistance as well? And how important is that in terms of keeping everybody on board and on side?
So progressive attitude, perhaps, because, you know, Austria is an incredibly traditional country, but progressive in the sense of employee engagement, you know, that's existed within our DNA. And my great-grandfather Daniel came from Bohemia. He was lucky enough to choose Austria as his destination because eventually the Iron Curtain fell and Bohemia became the Czech Republic. Because he came from such a humble environment, the way he embraced his employees in Austria as an immigrant from Prussia, theoretically, you know, was so groundbreaking. And, you know, his wife actually cooked for the employees for lunch. Everyone was involved. Everyone was just, it was complete teamwork. And he developed this kind of ethos and philosophy and spirit in the organization. You know, he developed a housing system. He eventually developed a big canteen. He had the medical support facility. We created a football club. He had a band. So after World War II, most Austrian companies were made public. They could not make Swarovski public because we had greater benefits than any company had in Austria. And that is driven from family values. And I think in terms of, you know, as you were saying, employee engagement, the reason why this is so strong now, we still feel, you know, it is a family. We are a family business. And when it's a family business, your sense of accountability is so strong. And I certainly have the attitude, my gosh, I feel so grateful for anyone who's working for Swarovski. They're giving time of their life to us. I want to make sure that the company gives back to them. Is that intellectual growth via what they're doing? Is it fulfillment? Certainly the financial reward. But I want people to feel emotionally and intellectually satisfied when they come and work for Swarovski. So maybe that's progressive. And that also means, you know, especially if we're hiring younger people, it's so great. You know, we learn from their knowledge. What is Swarovski giving them to learn? And what platform is Swarovski providing for our employees to extend themselves? And on that note, I have to say, in terms of the career progression of my colleagues, I always say to them, you know what? You're in charge of that. I'm not in charge of your career progression. It's very simple. You work hard. the ladder of success is very steep. You don't work hard, well, and again, it goes back to energy. That's that even exchange of energy.
Does it ever depress you? I mean, it's interesting. You talk there about this idea of companies built on the backs of immigrants who were hungry to explore new opportunities and to share their wealth, literally and metaphorically, with others. You look around the world at the moment, it often seems much more insular, much more inward looking. We're sat here in the UK, we've voted to leave the European Union, all these things which seem to make no sense in that context.
Yeah, really.
Does it worry you? Does it depress you that we're hearing voices from the right wing, nationalists who don't seem to understand these same sets of values? I mean, have we become complacent? Why is this happening? Because, you know, Austria has its own populist voices who sort of made more noise in the elections, this kind of thing. Does it worry you, or do you think that we can have confidence that these enduring values will out in the end?
I certainly believe that enduring values will be stronger than the re, but I think it's incredibly worrying that certain situations, certain countries are the way they are. And I think it's often a lack of the big picture. You know, I have to say, just again, growing up in Austria in the 70s, you know, Eastern Europe felt so close. Communism felt so close. I remember when Austria joined the EU, that was just so amazing. It was so enabling for Austria. Everything was gray after the war. It was so depressing. You know, and Austria was the battlefield, so everyone was affected, and you could still feel that vibe. And I just feel so sorry for the UK. Yes, the UK was a
It was the vote. We've done it to ourselves.
I know, but I think it's voted by people that actually don't understand how lucky they are and actually don't understand how important that internationalization is. That's really sad. And I have to say, it makes me sad speaking to some UK universities. You know, they really appreciate the foreign influx simply because of the extended brain power and exchange of ideas. And it would be such a shame if we would lose that. On the other hand, this entire situation that we're seeing now politically is also encouraging every individual, but also companies, in particular private companies, to step up, be more accountable.
Well,
I
wanted to ask you about this, because how comfortable are you being a leader in that way? Because again, people will know about other partnerships you have, support of different initiatives. You've been recognized by the Women for Women International. You support very different causes from National Ballet and so on and so forth. Many people might say, well, hang on, that's the role of the state. That's the role of central government to ensure, safeguard, often quite fundamental rights.
Right.
Are you happy to be for the leadership to come from the private
absolutely.
Sector?
So if the values are right, absolutely happy. You know what I mean? And it's so true. Every single drop counts. Every single voice within the organization counts. Every single organization counts. Everyone will have an impact. So if you know that, why not have that positive impact and be very conscious about it and be mindful about it? And of course, voice in that space is very relevant to our consumers. 80% of our consumers are women, so we've really chosen certain topics that relate to women, whether it's in third world countries or in this environment. You know, yes, we are touching upon the equality pay issues when we're working with women in film, for example, or we're dealing with third world countries working with women for women, where women who are more often widows and have witnessed their husbands and children killed in front of them, or financially supported to build up their own businesses, therefore gain a sense of purpose, therefore have a very positive impact on the community. It's amazing. I think if we're doing that, the general population will see that we're doing that as a private company, and they will realize that they too, as individuals or as other companies, can do that. And many companies, of course, are doing it. And we're seeing a lot coming out of the United States, and a lot of benevolent work. But I really think, you know, it's time for great individualism and hopefully individualism with the right values and for the right cause.
Now, a lot of this, we've been reflecting on some of these values, a lot of these programs. I just want to ask you a bit about your role as a woman, a very prominent woman, both on the board, of course, and in your role as a sort of representative of Swarovski. You mentioned these alliances within the sort of film industry, and that's an industry very much in the spotlight at the moment for a number of rather unfortunate reasons. And looking at the role of women, and does misogyny dominate in some of these fields? How's the progress been in that respect for you personally? Do you still feel like, you know, sometimes a lone voice? Does that depress you? Does it worry you? We have initiatives like the 30% Club trying to up the representation of women in management roles on the boards of companies. And we know that companies do better when they have more women on the board. Why is it still a battle to get a more equal representation of women in those roles, do you think?
First of all, it's interesting. It comes down to education. My children went to school here in London, and although my son and my daughters were in the same school, they had to dress very differently. And one of my daughters is a very sporty person, yet she had to wear the dress with the little bloomers and the straw hat. It was totally pigeonholing. That's how we're raised. So it starts there. But it also continues with how do fathers treat their daughters? How do mothers treat their sons? And so on. How are you, you know? But in any case, one thing that's been really great for Swarovski is to team up with the UN Women Empowerment Program. The first thing they say is they are here to support mankind. Because it's an organization that supports women does not mean they're against men. They appreciate men. And only with men the change can be made. And it really is an initiative that is pro mankind, a better mankind. And that goes back to values. So I truly believe the minute we see a value shift or just the clarity of what our values are, and then actually you can proceed so much more with kindness and collaboration, I think there'll be greater equality. But I also think that it's going to be the next generation where we will see the impact of greater equality. When a son watches his working mother, and perhaps a mother who is the main provider, that son will grow up thinking totally differently about women. And at the end of the day, it is really also, it's about your intellectual existence and it's about your emotional existence. And I think when people can see that on that level, I think we'll see greater equality. I also think it's really great for men. I think it's been so tough for men to be so pigeonholed. I think it's been tough for men to have to be tough. Men are humans, you know? And it's just so sad that when a man expresses emotion, he is pegged as being weak. I mean, men suffer just as much as women, but it's just not addressed.
Let's look, Nadia, to the future. Lots of these themes, one imagines, will come back, whether that's the long-term payoff from investment in education, from this value shift that you've described, from what we hope is the triumph of progressive attitudes, progressive politics, even in the face of various challenges. What does the future hold for Swarovski, for Nadia Swarovski indeed? What will that conversation look like if we were sat here in, I don't know, 5 years' time?
Well, you know, I refer to my colleagues who have a new motto, and that motto is world domination. No, in any case, I have to say, I feel so grateful that I am working for a company with its family heritage, but I'm grateful to work for a company that had such a great motto from day one. You know, my great-grandfather developed the stone because he wanted every woman to know what it feels like to wear a diamond. He wanted to empower women in that sense, you know. And we often talk about our product as the democratization of luxury. I certainly see Swarovski, the crystal in itself, the nature of the crystal, it's a lens that captures the light and refracts it. It makes life brighter and happier. You know, and it is so positive. So that is really where I see a symbolic or emotional connection with the product. And I see Swarovski such an incredible platform in order to promote positive values, positive action. We're certainly promoting collaboration versus competition. I'm grateful that Swarovski has a voice in the industry. I hope we have a positive impact. I can see this company evolving beyond just creating a material, tangible product to convey a platform of positive values, of that inner strength. And speaking of that, what's really important in terms of values, the fact that we are working so much also on the preservation of nature. You know, we come from the Tyrolean Alps. We love our environment. We have these incredible engineers who've worked very hard to make sure that the creation of this product is done in a sustainable and ethical, certainly, way. So that's another thing where Swarovski, I see becoming or staying a leader in the forefront of sustainability, sharing its knowledge and know-how in sustainable manufacturing in the industry.
What more can
I
be said?
I can answer that question in so many different ways. I'm too embarrassed and too shy, but stay tuned. Let's talk again in 5 years.
Exactly. We'll revisit it in 5 years' time. And Nadia, an illuminating note on which to end. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us on The Big Interview.
Yes, thank you so much. It was such an honor.
The Big Interview is produced by Gaia Lutz and edited by Cassie Galpin. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.